Lord of Chaos by Robert Jordan. This book is read by Michael Kramer and Kate Redding. The lions sing and the hills take flight, the moon by day and the sun by night. Blind woman, deaf man, jackdaw fool, let the Lord of Chaos rule. Chant from a children's game, heard in great Aravalan, the Fourth Age. Prologue. The First Message. Dimandred stepped out onto the black slopes of Shael Ghul, and the gateway, a hole in reality's fabric, winked out of existence. Above, roiling gray clouds hid the sky, an inverted sea of sluggish ashen waves crashing around the mountain's hidden peak. Below, odd lights flashed across the barren valley, washed out blues and reds, failing to dispel the dusky murk that shrouded their source. Lightning streaked up at the clouds, and slow thunder rolled. Across the slope, steam and smoke rose from scattered vents, some holes as small as a man's hand, and some large enough to swallow 10 men. He released the one power immediately, and with the vanished sweetness went the heightened senses that made everything sharper, clearer. The absence of Sidene left him hollow. Yet here only a fool would even appear ready to channel. Besides, here only a fool would want to see or smell or feel too clearly. In what was now called the Age of Legends, this had been an idyllic island in a cool sea, a favorite of those who enjoyed the rustic. Despite the steam, it was bitter cold now. He did not allow himself to feel it, but instinct made him pull his fur-lined velvet cloak closer. Feathery mist marked his breath, barely visible before the air drank it. A few hundred leagues north, the world was pure ice. But Thakandar was always dry as any desert, though always wrapped in winter. There was water, of a sort, an inky rivulet oozing down the rocky slope beside a gray-roofed forge. Hammers rang inside, and with every ring, white light flared in the cramped windows. A ragged woman crouched in a hopeless heap against the forge's rough stone wall, clutching a babe in her arms, and a spindly girl buried her face in the woman's skirts. Prisoners from a raid down into the borderlands, no doubt. But so few. The Murdral must be gnashing their teeth. Their blades failed after a time and had to be replaced, no matter that raids into the borderlands had been curtailed. One of the forgers emerged, a thick, slow-moving man-shape that seemed hacked out of the mountain. The forgers were not truly alive. Carried any distance from Shael Ghul, they turned to stone or dust. Nor were they smiths as such. They made nothing but the swords. This one's two hands held a sword blade in long tongs, a blade already quenched, pale like moonlit snow. Alive or not, the forger took care as it dipped the gleaming metal into the dark stream. Whatever semblance of life it had could be ended by the touch of that water. When the metal came out again, it was dead black. But the making was not done yet. The forger shuffled back inside, and suddenly a man's voice raised a desperate shout.
No, no, no!
He shrieked then, the sound dwindling away without losing intensity, as though the screamer had been yanked into unimaginably far distance. Now the blade was done. Once more a forger appeared, perhaps the same, perhaps another, and hauled the woman to her feet. Woman, babe, and child began to wail, but the infant was pulled away and shoved into the girl's arms. At last the woman found a scrap of resistance. Weeping, she kicked wildly, clawed at the forger. It paid no more mind than stone would have. The woman's cries vanished as soon as she was inside. The hammers began ringing again, drowning the sobs of the children. One blade made, one making, and two to come. Dimandred had never before seen fewer than 50 prisoners waiting to give their might to the great Lord of the Dark. The Murdral must be gnashing their teeth indeed.
"Do you loiter when you have been summoned by the great lord?"
The voice sounded like rotted leather crumbling. Demondred turned slowly. How dare a half-man address him in that tone? But the quelling words died in his mouth. It was not the eyeless stare of its pasty pale face. A murderall's gaze struck fear into any man, but he had rooted fear out of himself long ago. Rather, it was the black-clad creature itself. Every murderall was the height of a tall man, a sinuous imitation of a man, as alike as though cast in one mold. This one stood head and shoulders taller.
"I will take you to the great lord," the murderall said. "I am Shaidar Haran."
It turned away and began climbing the mountain, like a serpent in its fluid motion. Its inky cloak hung unnaturally still, without even a ripple. Demondred hesitated before following. Half-men's names were always in the Trolloc's tongue-wrenching language. Shaidar Haran came from what people now name the Old Tongue. It meant Hand of the Dark. Another surprise. And Demondred did not like surprises, especially not at Sheol Ghul. The entry into the mountain could have been one of the scattered vents, except that it emitted no smoke or steam. It gaped enough for two men abreast, but the murderall kept the lead. The way slanted down almost immediately, the tunnel floor worn smooth as polished tiles. The cold faded as Demondred followed Shaidar Haran's broad back down and down, slowly replaced by increasing heat. Demondred was aware of it, but did not let it touch him. A pale light rose from the stone, filling the tunnel, brighter than the eternal twilight outside. Jagged spikes jutted from the ceiling, stony teeth ready to snap shut. The great lord's teeth to rend the unfaithful or the traitor. Not natural, of course, but effective. Abruptly, he noticed something. Every time he had made this journey, those spikes had all but brushed the top of his head. Now they cleared the murderalls by two hands or more. That surprised him. Not that the height of the tunnel changed. The strange was ordinary here. But the extra space the half-man was given. The great lord gave his reminders to murderall as well as men. That extra space was a fact to be remembered. The tunnel opened out suddenly onto a wide ledge overlooking a lake of molten stone, red, mottled with black, where man-high flames danced, died, and rose again. There was no roof, only a great hole rising through the mountain to a sky that was not the sky of Thakandar. It made that of Thakandar look normal, with its wildly striated clouds streaking by as though driven by the greatest winds the world had ever seen. This men called the Pit of Doom, and few knew how well they had named it. Even after all his visits, and the first lay well over 3,000 years in the past, Demondred felt awe. Here he could sense the bore, the hole drilled through so long ago to where the great lord had lain imprisoned since the moment of creation. Here the great lord's presence washed over him. Physically, this place was no closer to the bore than any other in the world, but here there was a thinness in the pattern that allowed it to be sensed. Demondred came as close to smiling as he ever did. What fools they were who opposed the great lord. Oh, the bore was still blocked, though more tenuously than when he had wakened from his long sleep and broken free of his own prison in it. Blocked, but larger than when he woke. Still not so large as when he had been cast into it with his fellows at the end of the War of Power, but at each visit since waking, a little wider. Soon the blockage would be gone, and the great lord would reach out across the earth again. Soon would come the day of return, and he would rule the world for all time. Under the great lord, of course, and with those of the other chosen who survived, also, of course. "You may leave now, half-man." He did not want the thing here to see the ecstasy overcome him. The ecstasy and the pain. Shaidar Haran did not move. Demandred opened his mouth, and a voice exploded in his head.
Demandred!
To call it a voice was to call a mountain a pebble. It nearly crushed him against the inside of his own skull. It filled him with rapture. He sank to his knees. The murderer stood watching him passively, but only a small part of him could even notice the thing with that voice filling his brain.
Demandred, how fares this world?
He was never sure how much the great lord knew of the world. He had been as startled by ignorance as by knowledge. But he had no doubt what the great lord wanted to hear.
Ravin is dead, great lord. Yesterday.
There was pain. Euphoria too strong became pain quickly. His arms and legs twitched. He was sweating now.
Lanfear has vanished without a trace, just as Asmodian did.
And Grendel says Mogedion failed to meet her as they had agreed.
Also yesterday, great lord. I do not believe in coincidence.
The chosen dwindle, Demandred. The weak fall away. Who betrays me shall die the final death. Asmodian, twisted by his weakness. Ravin dead in his pride. He served well, yet even I cannot save him from balefire. Even I cannot step outside of time.
For an instant, terrible anger filled that awful voice, and could it be frustration? An instant only.
Done by my ancient enemy, the one called Dragon. Would you unleash the balefire in my service, Demandred?
Demandred hesitated. A bead of sweat slid half an inch on his cheek. It seemed to take an hour. For a year, during the War of Power, both sides had used balefire, until they learned the consequences. Without agreement or truce, there had never been a truce any more than there had been quarter, each side simply stopped. Entire cities died in balefire that year. Hundreds of thousands of threads burned from the pattern. Reality itself almost unraveled, world and universe evaporating like mist. If balefire was unleashed once more, there might be no world to rule. Another point pricked him. The great lord already knew how Ravin had died, and seemed to know more of Asmodian than he.
As you command, great lord, so shall I obey.
His muscles might be jerking, but his voice was rock steady. His knees began to blister from the hot stone, yet the flesh might as well have been someone else's.
So you shall.
Great lord, the dragon can be destroyed.
A dead man could not wield balefire again, and perhaps then the great lord would see no need for it.
He is ignorant and weak, scattering his attentions in a dozen directions. Ravin was a vain fool.
Would you be nameless?
Demandred's tongue froze. Nameless. The one who would stand only a step below the great lord, commanding all the others.
I wish only to serve you, great lord, however I may.
Nameless.
Then listen and serve. Hear who will die and who live.
Demandred screamed as the voice crashed home. Tears of joy rolled down his face. Unmoving, the murderer watched him.
Stop fidgeting. Nynaeve testily flipped her long braid over her shoulder. This won't work if you twitch around like children with an itch. Neither of the women across the rickety table appeared any older than she, though they were by 20 years or more, and neither was really fidgeting. But the heat had Nynaeve on edge. The small windowless room seemed airless. She dripped sweat. They appeared cool and dry. Lyanna, in a Domani dress of too thin blue silk, merely shrugged. The tall, coppery-skinned woman possessed an apparently infinite store of patience. Usually. Swan, fair and sturdy, seldom had any. Now Swan grunted and resettled her skirts irritably. She used to wear fairly plain clothes, but this morning she was in fine yellow linen embroidered with a Tyran maze around a neckline that barely missed being too low. Her blue eyes were cold as deep well water, as cold as deep well water would have been if the weather had not gone mad. Her dresses might have changed, but not her eyes. "It won't work in any case," she snapped. Her manner of speaking was the same, too. "You can't patch a hull when the whole boat's burned. Well, it's a waste of time, but I promised, so get on with it. Liana and I have work to do." The pair of them ran the networks of eyes and ears for the Aes Sedai here in Salidar, the agents who sent in reports and rumors of what was going on in the world. Nynaeve smoothed her own skirts to soothe herself. Her dress was plain white wool, with 7 bands of color at the hem, 1 for each Aja, an accepted's dress. It annoyed her more than she could ever have imagined. She would much rather have been in the green silk she had packed away. She was willing to admit her acquired taste for fine clothes, privately at least, but her choice of that particular dress was only for comfort. It was thin, light, not because green seemed one of Lan's favorite colors. Not at all. Idle dreaming of the worst sort. An accepted who put on anything except the banded white would soon learn she was a long step below Aes Sedai. Firmly she put all that out of her head. She was not here to fret over fripperies. He liked blue, too. No. Delicately she probed with the one power, first at Swan, then Liana. In a manner of speaking, she was not channeling at all. She could not channel a scrap unless angry, could not even sense the true source. Yet it came to the same thing. Fine filaments of Saidar, the female half of the true source, sifted through the two women at her weaving. They just did not originate with her. On her left wrist, Nynaeve wore a slender bracelet, a simple, segmented silver band. Mainly silver, anyway, and from a special source, though that made no difference. It was the only piece of jewelry she wore aside from the great serpent ring. Accepted were firmly discouraged from wearing much jewelry. A matching necklace snugged around the neck of the fourth woman on a stool against the rough-plastered wall with her hands folded in her lap. Clad in a farmer's rough brown wool, with a farmer's worn, sturdy face, she did not sweat a drop. She did not move a muscle either, but her dark eyes watched everything. To Nynaeve, the radiance of Saidar surrounded her, but it was Nynaeve who directed the channeling. Bracelet and necklace created a link between them, much in the way Aes Sedai could link to combine their power. Something about absolutely identical matrices was involved, according to Elaine, after which the explanation truly became incomprehensible. In truth, Nynaeve did not think Elaine understood half as much as she pretended. For herself, Nynaeve did not understand at all, except that she could feel the other woman's every emotion, feel the woman herself, but tucked away in a corner of her head, and that all the other woman's grasp of Saidar was in her control. Sometimes she thought it would have been better if the woman on the stool were dead. Simpler, certainly. Cleaner. "There's something torn, or cut," Nynaeve muttered, wiping absently at the sweat on her face. It was just a vague impression, barely there at all, but it was also the first time she had sensed more than emptiness. It could be imagination, and the desperate wanting to find something, anything. "Severing," the woman on the stool said. That was what it was called, what you name stilling for women and gentling for men. 3 heads swiveled toward her. 3 sets of eyes glared with fury. Swan and Liana had been Aes Sedai until they were still during the coup in the White Tower that put Elida on the Amarlin seat. Stilled. A word to cause shudders. Never to channel again, but always to remember and know the loss. Always to sense the true source and know you could never touch it again. Stilling could not be healed any more than death. That was what everyone believed anyway, but in Nynaeve's opinion the one power should be able to heal anything short of death. "If you have something useful to add, Marigan," she said sharply, "then say it. If not, keep quiet." Marigan shrank back against the wall, eyes glittering and fixed on Nynaeve. Fear and hate rolled through the bracelet, but they always did, to one degree or another. Captives seldom loved their captors, even, perhaps especially, when they knew they deserved captivity and worse. The problem was that Marigan also said severing, stilling, could not be healed. Oh, she was full of claims that anything else except death could be healed in the age of legends, that what the Yellow Aja called healing now was only the crudest, hasty battlefield work. But try to pin her down on specifics, on even a hint of how, and you found nothing there. Marigan knew as much about healing as Nynaeve did about blacksmithing, which was that you stuck metal in hot coals and hit it with a hammer. Certainly not enough to make a horseshoe, or heal much beyond a bruise. Twisting around in her chair, Nynaeve studied Swan and Lyanna. Days of this, whenever she could pry them away from their other work, and so far she had learned nothing. Suddenly she realized she was turning the bracelet on her wrist. Whatever the gain, she hated being linked to the woman. The intimacy made her skin crawl. "At least I might learn something," she thought. "And it couldn't fail any worse than everything else has." Carefully she undid the bracelet. The clasp was impossible to find unless you knew how, and handed it to Swan. "Put this on." Losing the power was bitter, but this had to be done. And losing the waves of emotion was like taking a bath. Marigan's eyes followed the narrow length of silver as if hypnotized. "Why?" Swan demanded. "You tell me this thing only works. Just put it on, Swan." Swan eyed her stubbornly for a moment. Light, but the woman could be obstinate, before closing the bracelet around her wrist. A look of wonder came onto her face immediately, then her eyes narrowed at Marigan. "She hates us, but I knew that. And there's fear and shock. Not a glimmer on her face, but she's shocked to her toes. I don't think she believed I could use this thing either." Marigan shifted uneasily. So far, only two who knew about her could use the bracelet. Four would give more chances for questions. On the surface, she seemed to be cooperating fully, but how much was she hiding? As much as she could, Nynaeve was sure. With a sigh, Swan shook her head. "And I cannot. I should be able to touch the source through her, isn't that right? Well, I can't. A grunter could climb trees first. I've been stilled, and that is that. How do you get this thing off?" She fumbled at the bracelet. "How do you bloody get it off?" Gently, Nynaeve laid a hand over Swan's on the bracelet. "Don't you see? The bracelet won't work for a woman who can't channel, any more than the necklace would work on her. If I put either on one of the cooks, it would be no more than a pretty piece for her." "Cooks or no cooks," Swan said flatly. "I cannot channel. I have been stilled." "But there is something there to be healed," Nynaeve insisted. "Or you'd feel nothing through the bracelet." Swan jerked her arm free and stuck her wrist out. "Take it off." Shaking her head, Nynaeve complied. Sometimes Swan could be as bull-headed as any man. When she held the bracelet toward Lyanna, the Damani woman lifted her wrist eagerly. Lyanna pretended to be as sanguine over having been stilled as Swan was, as Swan pretended to be. But she did not always succeed. Supposedly the only way to survive stilling for long was to find something else to fill your life, to fill the hole left by the one power. For Swan and Lyanna, that something was running their networks of agents, and more importantly, trying to convince the Aes Sedai here in Salidar to support Randall Thor as the Dragon Reborn, without letting any of the Aes Sedai know what they were doing. The question was whether that was enough. The bitterness on Swan's face, and the delight on Lyanna's as the bracelet snapped shut, said that maybe nothing could ever be. "Oh, yes." Lyanna had a brisk, clipped way of speaking. Except when talking to men, anyway. She was Damani, after all, and of late making up for time lost in the tower. Yes, she really is stunned, isn't she? Beginning to control it now, though. For a few moments she sat silently, considering the woman on the stool. Marigan stared back warily. At last, Liana shrugged. I cannot touch the source either. And I tried to make her feel a flea bite on her ankle. If it had worked, she would have had to show something. That was the other trick of the bracelet. You could make the woman wearing the necklace feel physical sensations. Only the sensations. There was no mark, whatever you did. No real damage. But the feel of a sound switching or two had sufficed to convince Marigan that cooperation was her best choice. That, and the alternative, a quick trial followed by execution. Despite her failure, Liana watched closely as Nynaeve undid the bracelet and refastened it on her own wrist. It seemed that she, at least, had not given up completely on channeling again one day. Regaining the power was wonderful. Not as wonderful as drawing Sayidar herself, being filled with it, but even touching the source through the other woman was like redoubling the life in her veins. To hold Sayidar inside was to want to laugh and dance with pure joy. She supposed that one day she would become used to it. Full Aes Sedai must. Balanced against that, linking with Marigan was a small price. Now that we know there's a chance, she said, I think... The door banged open, and Nynaeve was on her feet before she knew it. She never thought of using the power. She would have screamed if her throat had not closed tight. She was not the only one, but she hardly noticed Swan and Liana leaping up. The fear cascading through the bracelet seemed an echo of her own. The young woman who shut the splintery wooden door behind her took no notice of the commotion she had caused. Tall and straight in an accepted's banded white dress, with sun-gold curls nestled on her shoulders, she looked spitting mad. Even with her face tight with anger and dripping sweat, she somehow managed to look beautiful, though. It was a knack Elaine had. "Do you know what they're doing? They are sending an embassy to Caemlyn, and they refuse to let me go. Shiriam forbade me to mention it again. Forbade me even to speak of it. Did you never learn to knock, Elaine?" Straightening her chair, Nynaeve sat down again. Fell, really. Relief weakened her knees. "I thought you were, Shiriam." Just the thought of discovery cored out her middle. To her credit, Elaine blushed and apologized immediately, then spoiled it by adding, "But I don't see why you were so goosey. Birgitta is still outside, and you know she would warn you if anyone else came close. Nynaeve, they must let me go." "They must do nothing of the kind," Swan said gruffly. She and Liana were seated again, too. Swan sat up straight, as always, but Liana sagged back, as flimsy as Nynaeve's knees. Marigan was leaning against the wall, breathing hard, eyes closed and hands pressed hard against the plaster. Relief and stark terror surged through the bracelet in alternating jolts. "But..." Swan did not allow Elaine another word. "Do you think Shiriam or any of the others will let the daughter heir of Andor fall into the hands of the dragon reborn? With your mother dead? I don't believe that," Elaine snapped. "You don't believe Rand killed her," Swan went on relentlessly. "And that's a different thing. I don't either. But if Morghese were alive, she would come forward and acknowledge him, the dragon reborn. Or if she believed him a false dragon, in spite of the proof, she'd be organizing resistance. None of my eyes and ears have heard a whisper of either. Not just in Andor, but not here in Altara, and not in Mirandi." "They have," Elaine forced in. "There's rebellion in the West." "Against Morghese." "Against. If it's not a rumor, too." Swan's voice was flat as a planed board. "Your mother is dead, girl. Best to admit as much and get your weeping done." Elaine's chin rose, a very annoying habit she had. She was the picture of icy arrogance, though most men seemed to find it attractive for some reason. You complain continually over how long it is taking to get in touch with all of your agents, she said coolly. But I will set aside whether you can have heard all there is to hear. Whether my mother is alive or not, my place is in Camelin now. I am daughter heir. Swan's loud snort made Nynaeve jump. You've been accepted long enough to know better. Elaine had as much potential as had been seen in 1,000 years. Not as much as Nynaeve, if she ever learned to channel at will, but still enough to make any Aes Sedai's eyes light up. Elaine's nose wrinkled. She knew very well that if she had already been on the Lion Throne, the Aes Sedai still would have gotten her away for training, by asking if possible, by stuffing her into a barrel if necessary. And she opened her mouth, but Swan did not even slow down. True, they'd not mind you taking the throne sooner than later. There hasn't been a queen who was openly Aes Sedai in far too long. But they won't let you go until you're a full sister, and even then, because you are daughter heir and will be queen soon, they won't let you near the dragon bloody reborn until they know how far they can trust him. Especially since this amnesty of his. Her mouth twisted sourly around the word, and Lyanna grimaced. Nynaeve's tongue curdled, too. She'd been brought up to fear any man who could channel, fated to go mad, and before the shadow-tainted male half of the source killed him horribly, bring terror to everyone around him. But Rand, whom she had watched grow up, was the dragon reborn, born both as a sign that the last battle was coming, and to fight the Dark One in that battle. The dragon reborn, humanity's only hope, and a man who could channel. Worse, reports were that he was trying to gather others like him. Of course, there could not be many. Any Aes Sedai would hunt down one of those. The Red Aja did little else. But they found few, far fewer than once, according to the records. Elaine was not about to give up, though. That was one admirable thing about her. She would not give up if her head were on the block and the axe descending. She stood there with her chin up, facing Swan's stare, which Nynaeve often found hard to do. There are two clear reasons why I should go. First, whatever has happened to my mother, she is missing, and as daughter heir, I can calm the people and assure them the succession is intact. Second, I can approach Rand. He trusts me. I would be far better than anyone the Hall chooses. The Aes Sedai here in Salidar had chosen their own Hall of the Tower, a hall in exile, as it were. They were supposed to be mulling over the choice of a new Ammerlin seat, a rightful Ammerlin to challenge Elida's claim to the title and the tower, but Nynaeve had not seen much sign of it. "So kind of you to sacrifice yourself, child," Lyanna said dryly. Elaine's expression did not change, yet she colored furiously. Few outside this room knew, and no Aes Sedai, but Nynaeve had no doubt that Elaine's first act in Camelin would be to get Rand alone and kiss him within an inch of his life. "With your mother missing, if Randall Thor has you and Camelin, he has Andor, and the Hall won't let him have any more of Andor than they have to, or anywhere else if they can help it. He carries Tyr and Cairhien in his pocket, and the Aiel as well, it seems. Add Andor, and Morandi and Altara with us in it fall if he sneezes. He is growing too powerful too fast. He might decide he doesn't need us. With Moiraine dead, there's no one near him we can trust." That made Nynaeve wince. Moiraine was the Aes Sedai who had brought her and Rand out of the Two Rivers and changed their lives. Her and Rand and Egwene and Matt and Perrin. She had wanted for so long to make Moiraine pay for what she had done to them that losing her was like losing a piece of herself. But Moiraine was dead in Cairhien, taking Lanfear with her. She was fast becoming a legend among the Aes Sedai here, the only Aes Sedai to have killed one of the Forsaken, much less two. The only good thing Nynaeve could find in it, much as it shamed to find any good, was that now Lan was freed from being Moiraine's warder, if she could ever find him. Swan took up immediately where Lyanna left off. "We can't afford to let the boy go sailing off with no guidance at all. Who knows what he might do? Yes, yes, I know you're ready to argue for him, but I don't care to hear it. I'm trying to balance a live silver pike on my nose, girl. We can't let him grow too strong before he accepts us, and yet we don't dare hold him back too much. And I'm trying to keep Shiryam and the others convinced they should support him when half the Hall secretly don't want anything to do with him, and the other half think in their heart of hearts that he should be gentle, dragon reborn or not. In any case, whatever your arguments, I suggest you heed Shiryam. You won't change any minds, and Tiana doesn't have enough novices here to keep her busy. Elaine's face tightened angrily. Tiana Nocell, a gray sister, was mistress of novices here in Salidar. An accepted had to step considerably further out of line to be sent to Tiana than did a novice, but by the same token the visit was always that much more shaming and painful. Tiana might show a little kindness to a novice, if only a little. She felt accepted should know better, and made sure they felt the same long before they left her small cubbyhole of a study. Nynaeve had been studying Swan, and now something popped into her head. You knew all about this embassy, or whatever it is, didn't you? You two always have your heads together with Shiryam and her little circle. The Hall might have all the supposed authority until they chose an Amyrlin, but Shiryam and the handful of other Aes Sedai who had first organized the arrivals in Salidar still kept the real control of things. How many are they sending, Swan? Elaine gasped. Plainly she had not thought of this. That showed how upset she was. Usually she caught nuances Nynaeve missed. Swan denied nothing. Since being stilled, she could lie like a wool merchant, but when she decided to be open, she was as open as a slap in the face. 9. Enough to do honor to the dragon reborn. Fish guts! An embassy to a king is seldom more than 3, but not enough to frighten him. If he's learned enough to be frightened.
You had better hope he has, Elaine said coldly. If he hasn't, then 9, maybe 8 too many.
13 was the dangerous number. Rand was strong, perhaps as strong as any man since the breaking, but 13 Aes Sedai linked could overwhelm him, shield him from Sidheen, and take him prisoner. 13 was the number assigned when a man was gentled, though Nynaeve had begun to think the assignment more custom than requirement. Aes Sedai did a good many things because they always had. Swan's smile was far from pleasant. I wonder why no one else thought of that. Think, girl. Shiryam does, and so does the Hall. Only one will go near him at first and no more after that than he's comfortable with. But he'll know 9 came, and somebody will certainly tell him what an honor that is.
I see, Elaine said in a small voice. I should have known one of you would think of it. I'm sorry.
That was another good thing about her. She could be stubborn as a cross-eyed mule, but when she decided she was wrong, she admitted it as nicely as any village woman. Most unusual for a noble.
Min will be going too, Lyanna said. Her talents may be useful to Rand. The sisters won't know that part, of course. She can keep her secrets, as if that were the important thing.
I see, Elaine said again, flatly this time.
She made an effort to brighten her tone, a miserable failure.
Well, I see you're busy with Marigan. I did not mean to disturb you. Please, don't let me interrupt.
She was gone before Nynaeve could open her mouth, the door banging shut behind her. Angrily, Nynaeve rounded on Lyanna. I thought Swan was the mean one of you, but that was vicious. It was Swan who answered.
When two women love the same man, it means trouble, and when the man is Randall Thor, the light knows how sane he still is or what course they might send him off on. If there's any hair-pulling and clawing to be done, let them do it now, here.
Without thought, Nynaeve's hand found her braid and jerked it back over her shoulder.
I ought to... Trouble was, there was little she could do, and nothing to make any difference.
We'll go on from where we left off when Elaine came in. But, Swan, if you ever do something like that to her again, or to me, she thought, I'll make you sorry you... Where do you think you're going?
Swan had scraped back her chair and risen, and after a glance Lyanna did the same.
"We have work," Swan said curtly, already heading for the door.
"You promised to make yourself available, Swan. Shiryam told you to." Not that Shiryam thought it any less a waste of time than Swan, but Nynaeve and Elaine had earned rewards and a certain amount of indulgence, like Marigan to be their maid, to give them more time for accepted studies. Swan gave her an amused look from the door. "Maybe you'll complain to her and explain how you do your research. I want time with Marigan this evening. I have some more questions." As Swan left, Lyanna said sadly, "It would be nice, Nynaeve, but we have to do what we can do. You could try Loghain." Then she was gone, too. Nynaeve scowled. Studying Loghain had taught her even less than studying the two women. She was no longer certain she could learn anything from him at all. Anyway, the last thing she wanted was to heal a gentled man. He made her nervous in any case. "You bite at one another like rats in a sealed box," Marigan said. "On the evidence, your chances are not very good. Perhaps you should consider other options."
"Hold your filthy tongue," Nynaeve glared at her. "Hold it, the light burn you."
Fear still oozed through the bracelet, but something else as well, something almost too feeble to exist. A faint spark of hope, perhaps.
"The light burn you," she muttered.
The woman's real name was not Marigan, but Mogedion. One of the Forsaken, trapped with her own overweening pride and held prisoner in the midst of Aes Sedai. Only 5 women in the world knew, none Aes Sedai, but keeping Mogedion's secret was purest necessity. The Forsaken's crimes made her execution as sure as the sun rising. Swan agreed. For every Aes Sedai who counseled waiting, if any did, 10 would demand immediate justice. Into an unmarked grave with her would go all her knowledge from the Age of Legends, when things undreamed of today were done with the power. Nynaeve was not sure she believed half of what the woman told her of that age. She certainly understood less than half. Digging information out of Mogedion was not easy. Sometimes it was like healing. Mogedion had never been interested in much that could not advance her, preferably by shortcuts. The woman was hardly likely to reveal the truth, but Nynaeve suspected she had been some sort of swindler or the like before swearing her soul over to the Dark One. Sometimes she and Elaine just did not know the questions to ask. Mogedion seldom volunteered anything, that was certain. Even so, they had learned a great deal, and passed most on to the Aes Sedai. As results of their researches and studies as accepted, of course, they had gained a lot of credit. She and Elaine would have kept knowledge of her to themselves if they could, but Birgitta had known from the start, and Swan and Lyanna had to be told. Swan had known enough of the circumstances that led to Mogedion's capture to demand a full explanation, and had the leverage to obtain one. Nynaeve and Elaine knew some of Swan and Lyanna's secrets. They seemed to know all of her and Elaine's, except the truth about Birgitta. It made for a precarious balance, with the advantage to Swan and Lyanna. Besides, bits of Mogedion's revelations concerned supposed Dark Friend plots and hints of what the other Forsaken might be up to. The only way to pass those on was to make them seem to have come from Swan and Lyanna's agents. Nothing about the Black Aja, hidden deep and long denied, though that interested Swan most. Dark Friends disgusted her, but the very idea of Aes Sedai swearing themselves to the Dark One was enough to screw Swan's anger to an icy rage. Mogedion claimed to have been afraid to go near any Aes Sedai, and that was believable enough. Fear was a permanent part of the woman. No wonder she had hidden in the shadows enough to be called the Spider. All in all, she was a treasure trove too valuable to give to the headsman, yet most Aes Sedai would not see it so. Most Aes Sedai might refuse to touch or trust anything learned from her. Guilt and revulsion stabbed Nynaeve, not for the first time.
Could any amount of knowledge justify keeping one of the Forsaken from justice? Turning her in meant punishment, probably dreadful, for everyone involved, not just herself, but Elaine and Swan and Liana. Turning her in meant Birgitta's secret would come out, and all that knowledge lost. Mogedion might know nothing of healing, but she had given Nynaeve a dozen hints of what was possible, and there had to be more in her head. With those to guide her, what might she discover eventually? Nynaeve wanted a bath, and it had nothing to do with the heat. "We will talk about the weather," she said bitterly. "You know more about controlling weather than I do." Mogedion sounded weary, and an echo slid through the bracelet. There had been enough questions on the subject. "All I know is that what is happening is the Dark One's work." She had the nerve to smile ingratiatingly at the slip. "No mere human is strong enough to change that." It took effort for Nynaeve not to grind her teeth. Elaine knew more about working weather than anyone else in Salidar, and she said the same, including the Dark One part, though any but a fool would know that, with the heat so strong when it should be coming on for snow, with no rain and the streams drying. "Then we'll talk about using different weaves to heal different illnesses." The woman said that took more time than what was done now, but all the strength for it came from the power, not from the patient and the woman channeling. Of course, she said, men had actually been better at some kinds of healing, and Nynaeve was not about to believe that. "You must have seen it done at least once." She settled down to bore away for nuggets in the dross. Some knowledge was worth a great deal. She just wished she did not feel that she was digging through slime. Elaine did not hesitate once she was outside, only waved to Birgitta and went on. Birgitta, her golden hair in an intricate waist-long braid, was playing with two small boys while she kept watch in the narrow alley, her bow propped against a leaning fence beside her, or trying to play with them. Jarl and Sieve stared at the woman in her odd, wide yellow trousers and short, dark coat, but they showed no more reaction than that. They never did, and they never spoke. They were supposed to be Marigan's children. Birgitta was happy playing with them, and a touch sad. She always liked playing with children, especially little boys, and she always felt that way when she did. Elaine knew it as well as she knew her own feelings. If she had thought Mogedion had anything to do with their condition. But the woman claimed they were as they had been when she picked them up for her disguise in Gildan, orphans in the street, and some of the Yellow Sisters said they had simply seen too much in the riots in Samara. Elaine could believe it from what she herself had encountered there. The Yellow Sisters said time and care would help them. Elaine hoped it was so. She hoped she was not allowing the one responsible to escape justice. She did not want to think about Mogedion now. Her mother. No, she definitely did not want to think about her. Min. And Rand. There had to be some way to handle this. Barely seeing Birgitta's return nod, she hurried up the alley and out onto the main street of Salidar beneath a cloudless, broiling midday sky. For years, Salidar had stood abandoned before Aes Sedai, fleeing Elida's coup, began to gather there, but now fresh thatch topped the houses, most of which showed considerable new repairs and patches, and the three large stone buildings that had been inns. One, the largest, was called the Little Tower by some. That was where the hall met. Only what was necessary had been done, of course. Cracked glass filled many windows, or none. More important matters were afoot than repointing stonework or painting. The dirt streets were filled to bursting. Not just with Aes Sedai, of course, but accepted in banded dresses and scurrying novices in pure white. Warders moving with the deadly grace of leopards, whether lean or bulky. Servants who had followed Aes Sedai from the tower, even a few children, and soldiers. The hall here was preparing to enforce its claims against Elida by arms, if necessary, just as soon as they chose a true Ammerlin seat. The distant clang of hammers, cutting through the crowd's murmur from forges outside the village, spoke of horses being shod,
armor being mended. A square-faced man, his dark hair heavy with gray, went riding slowly down the street in a buff-colored coat and battered breastplate. Picking his way through the crowd, he eyed marching clusters of men with long pikes on their shoulders, or bows. Gareth Bryn had agreed to recruit and lead the Salidar Hall's army, though Elaine wished she knew the full how and why. Something to do with Swan and Lyanna, though what she could not imagine, since he ran both women ragged, especially Swan, fulfilling some oath Elaine did not have the straight of either. Just that Swan complained bitterly about having to keep his room and his clothes clean, on top of her other duties. She complained, but she did it. It must have been a strong oath. Bryn's eyes passed across Elaine with barely a hesitation. He had been coolly polite and distant since she arrived in Salidar, though she had known him since her cradle. Until less than a year ago, he had been Captain General of the Queen's Guards in Andor. Once, Elaine had thought he and her mother would marry. No, she was not going to think of her mother. Min. She had to find Min and talk. No sooner had she begun to weave through the crowded, dusty street, though, than Two Eyes Sedai found her. There was no choice but to stop and curtsy while the throng streamed around them. Both women beamed. Neither sweated a drop. Pulling a handkerchief from her sleeve to dab at her face, Elaine wished she had already been taught that particular bit of Aes Sedai lore. "Good day, Anaya Sedai. Janya Sedai. Good day, child. Do you have any more discoveries for us today?" As usual, Janya Frende spoke as though there was no time to get the words out. "Such remarkable strides you've made, you and Nynaeve, especially for Accepted. I still don't see how Nynaeve does it when she has so many difficulties with the power, but I must say I'm delighted." Unlike most Brown sisters, often absent-minded beyond their books and studies, Janya Sedai was quite neat. Every short dark hair tidy around the ageless face that marked Aes Sedai who had worked long with the power. But the slender woman's appearance did hint at her Aja. Her dress was plain grey and stout wool. Brown seldom thought of clothes as more than decent covering. And even when she was talking to you, she wore a little frown, as though squinting in thought about something else entirely. She would have been pretty without that frown. "That way of wrapping yourself in light to become invisible. Remarkable. I'm sure someone will find how to stop the ripples so you can move about with it. And Karenna is quite excited over that little eavesdropping trick of Nynaeve's. Naughty of her to think of that, but useful. Karenna thinks she sees how to adapt it to talk to someone at a distance. Think of it. To talk with someone a mile away, or two, or even..." Anaya touched her arm and she cut off, blinking at the other Aes Sedai. "You are making great strides, Elaine," Anaya said calmly. The bluff-faced woman was always calm. Motherly was the word to describe her, and comforting usually, though Aes Sedai features made putting an age to her impossible. She was also one of the small circle around Shiriam who held the real power in Salidar. "Greater than any of us expected, truly, and we expected much. The first to make a Turangrial since the breaking. That is remarkable, child, and I want you to know that. You should be very proud." Elaine stared at the ground in front of her toes. Two waist-high boys went dodging by through the crowd, laughing. She wished no one were close enough to hear this. Not that any of the passers-by gave them a second glance. With so many Aes Sedai in the village, not even novices curtsied unless an Aes Sedai addressed them, and everyone had errands that needed to be done yesterday. She did not feel proud at all, not with all of their discoveries coming from Mogedion. There had been a good many, beginning with inverting, so a weave could not be seen by any but the woman who had woven it, yet they had not passed everything on. How to hide your ability to channel, for one. Without that, Mogedion would have been unmasked in hours. Any Aes Sedai within 2 or 3 paces of a woman could sense whether she could channel, and if they learned how to do that, they might learn how to penetrate it. And how to disguise yourself. Inverted weaves made Marigan look nothing at all like Mogedion. Some of what the women knew was just too repulsive. Compulsion, for instance.
bending people's will, and a way to implant instructions so the recipient would not even remember the orders when he carried them out. Worse things. Too repulsive and maybe too dangerous to trust anyone with. Nynaeve said they had to learn them in order to learn how to counter them, but Elaine did not want to. They were keeping so many secrets, telling so many lies to friends and people on their side, that she almost wished she could take the three oaths on the oath rod without waiting to be raised Aes Sedai. One of those bound you to speak no word that was not true, bound you as though a part of your flesh. I haven't done as well as I might with the Tarangreal, Aes Sedai. That, at least, was hers, and hers alone. The first had been the bracelet and necklace, a fact kept well hidden, needless to say, but they were an altered copy of a nasty invention, the Eidam, that the Shan-Chan left behind when their invasion was driven into the sea at Falma. The plain green disc that allowed someone not strong enough to work the invisibility trick—not many were—had been her idea from the first. She had no Angreal or Sa'angreal to study, so they had been impossible to make so far, and even after her ease in copying the Shan-Chan device, Tarangreal had not proven as easy as she had thought. They used the one power instead of magnifying it, used it for one specific purpose, to do one thing. Some could even be used by people who could not channel, even men. They should have been simpler. Maybe they were in function, but not simple to make. Her modest statement unleashed a torrent from Janya. "Nonsense, child, absolute nonsense. Why, I've no doubt that as soon as we are back in the tower and can test you properly and put the oath rod in your hand, you'll be raised to the shawl as well as the ring. No doubt. You really are fulfilling all the promise that was seen in you, and more. No one could have expected—" Anaya touched her arm again. It seemed a set signal, because once more Janya stopped and blinked. "No need to swell the child's head too far," Anaya said. "Elaine, I'll have no sulking out of you. You should have outgrown that long since." The mother could be firm as well as kindly. "I won't have you pouting over a few failures, not when your success was so wonderful." Elaine had made 5 tries at the stone disc. 2 did nothing, and 2 made you appear blurry as well as sick to your stomach. The one that worked had been the 3rd attempt. More than a few failures in Elaine's book. "Everything you've done is wonderful. You and Nynaeve, too." "Thank you," Elaine said. "Thank you both. I'll try not to be sulky." When Aes Sedai said you were sulky, the one thing you did not do was tell her you were not. "Will you excuse me, please? I understand the embassy to Camelon is leaving today, and I want to say goodbye to Min." They let her go, of course, though Janya might have taken 30 minutes to do so without Anaya there. Anaya eyed Elaine sharply. She surely knew all about the words with Shiriam, but said nothing. Sometimes an Aes Sedai's silences were as loud as words. Thumbing the ring on the 3rd finger of her left hand, Elaine darted on it a near trot, eyes focused far enough ahead that she could claim not to have seen anyone else who tried to stop her for congratulations. It might work, and it might mean a visit to Tiana. Indulgences for good work only went so far. Right that moment she would much prefer Tiana to praise she did not deserve. The gold ring was a serpent biting its own tail, the great serpent, a symbol of Aes Sedai, but worn by accepted too. When she donned the shawl, fringed in the color of the Aja she selected, she would wear it on the finger she chose. It would be the green Aja for her, of necessity. Only green sisters had more than one warder, and she wanted to have Rand. Or as much of him as she could, at least. The difficulty was that she had already bonded Birgitta, the first woman ever to become a warder. That was why she could sense Birgitta's feelings, how she knew Birgitta had gotten a splinter in her hand that morning. Only Nynaeve knew about the bond. Warders were for full Aes Sedai. For an accepted to overstep that bound, no indulgences in the world would save her hide. For them it had been necessity, not whim. Birgitta would have died else. But Elaine did not think that would make any difference. Breaking a rule with the power could be fatal for yourself and others. To set that firmly in your mind, Aes Sedai seldom let anyone get away with breaking any rule for any reason. There was so much subterfuge here in Salidar, not just Birgitta and Mogedion. One of the oaths kept an Aes Sedai from lying, but what was not spoken of did not have to be lied over. Moiraine had known how to weave a cloak of invisibility, maybe the same one they learned from Mogedion. Nynaeve had seen Moiraine do it once, before Nynaeve knew anything of the power. No one else in Salidar had known, though, or admitted to it anyway. Birgitta had confirmed what Elaine had begun to suspect. Most Aes Sedai, maybe all, kept back at least part of what they learned. Most had their own secret tricks. Those might become common knowledge taught to novices or accepted, if enough Aes Sedai learned them. Or they might die with the Aes Sedai. Two or three times she thought she had seen a glimmer in someone's eyes when she demonstrated something. Karenna had leaped onto the eavesdropping trick with suspicious quickness, but it was hardly the sort of accusation an accepted could make against Aes Sedai. Knowing did not make her own deceptions more palatable, but maybe it helped a little. That and remembering necessity. If only they would stop praising her for what she had not done. She was sure she knew where to find Min. The river Eldar lay not 3 miles west of Salidar, and a tiny stream ran through the edge of the village on its way through the forest to the river. Most of the trees that had grown up in the town had been cut down after Aes Sedai began arriving, but a small patch on the stream's bank remained behind some houses, on a scrap of land too narrow to be useful. Min claimed to like cities best, yet she often went to sit among those trees. It was a way to escape the company of Aes Sedai and warders a while, and for Min that was almost essential. Sure enough, when Elaine edged her way around the corner of a stone house onto the slender strip, along a runnel of water no wider, Min was sitting there with her back against a tree, watching the little brook burble over rocks. As much as was left of it. The stream trickled down a bed of dried mud twice as wide as it was. The trees held a few leaves here, though most of the surrounding forest was beginning to go bare. Even the oaks. A dried branch cracked under Elaine's slipper, and Min jumped to her feet. As usual, she wore a boy's gray coat and breeches, but she had had small blue flowers embroidered on the lapels and up the sides of the snug legs. Oddly, since she said the three aunts who raised her had been seamstresses, Min seemed not to know one end of a needle from the other. She stared at Elaine, then grimaced and ran her fingers through dark shoulder-length hair. "You know," was all she said. "I thought we should talk." Min scrubbed her hands through her hair again. "Swan didn't tell me until this morning. I've been trying to work up courage to tell you ever since. She wants me to spy on him, Elaine, for the embassy, and she gave me names in Camelin, people who can send messages back to her." "You won't do it, of course," Elaine said, without a hint of question, and Min gave her a grateful look. "Why were you afraid to come to me? We are friends, Min, and we promised each other not to let a man come between us, even if we do both love him." Min's laugh had a huskiness to it. Elaine supposed many men would find that attractive, and she was pretty in a mischievous sort of way, and a few years older. Was that in her favor or against? "Oh, Elaine, we said that when he was safely away from both of us. Losing you would be like losing a sister, but what if one of us changes her mind?" Best not to ask which of them that was supposed to be. Elaine tried not to think of the fact that if she bound and gagged Min with the power and inverted the weave, she might be able to hide the woman in a basement until the embassy was long gone. "We won't," she said simply. No, she could not do that to Min. She wanted Rand all to herself, but she could not hurt Min. Maybe she could just ask the other woman not to go until they both could. Instead, she said, "Is Gareth releasing you from your oath?" This time Min's laugh was a bark. "Hardly. He says he'll make me work it off sooner or later.
Swan's the one he really wants to hold on to, the light knows why. A slight tensing of her face made Elaine think there was a viewing involved in it, but she did not ask. Men never talked about those unless they concerned you. She had an ability known to few in Salidar. Elaine and Nynaeve, Swan and Lyanna, that was all. Birgitta did not know, but then Min did not know about Birgitta, or Mogideon. So many secrets. But Min's was her own. Sometimes she saw images or auras around people, and sometimes she knew what they meant. When she knew, she was always right. For instance, if she said a man and woman would marry, then sooner or later they married, even if they plainly hated one another now. Lyanna called it reading the pattern, but it had nothing to do with the power. Most people carried the images only occasionally, but Aes Sedai and warders always. Min's retreats here were to escape that deluge. "Will you carry a letter to Rand for me?" "Of course." The other woman's assent was so quick, her face so open, that Elaine blushed and went on hurriedly. She was not sure she would have agreed had the circumstances been reversed. "You mustn't let him know about your viewings, Min. Concerning us, I mean." One thing Min had viewed about Rand was that three women would fall hopelessly in love with him, be tied to him forever, and that one of them would be herself. The second had turned out to be Elaine. If he learns about the viewing, he might decide it isn't what we want, only the pattern, or his being Taviran. He could decide to be noble and save us by not letting either of us near him. "Maybe," Min said doubtfully. "Men are strange. More likely, if he realizes we'll both come running when he crooks a finger, he'll crook it. He won't be able to help himself. I've seen them do it. I think it has something to do with the hair on their chins." She had such a wondering look that Elaine was not sure whether or not that was a joke. Min seemed to know a lot about men. She'd worked mainly in stables. She liked horses. But once she had mentioned serving table in a tavern. "Either way, I won't tell. You and I will divide him up like a pie. Maybe we'll let the third have a bit of crust when she shows up."
"What are we going to do, Min?"
Elaine had not meant to say that. Certainly not in a near wail. Part of her wanted to say unequivocally that she would never come for a crooked finger. Part wanted him to crook it. Part of her wanted to say she would not share Rand, not in any way, not with anyone, even a friend, and Min's viewings could go to the pit of doom. Part wanted to box Rand's ears for doing this to her and Min. It was all so childish she felt like hiding her head, but she could not untangle the snarl in her feelings. Leveling her voice, she answered her own question before Min could. "What we're going to do is sit here a while and talk." She suited the words, choosing a spot where the dead leaves were particularly thick. A tree made a fine backrest. "Only not about Rand. I'm going to miss you, Min. It's so good to have a friend I can trust." Min sat cross-legged beside her and idly began digging up pebbles and tossing them into the stream. "Nynaeve is your friend. You trust her. And Birgitta certainly seems to be one. You spend more time with her than you do with Nynaeve, even." A slight frown creased her forehead. "Does she really believe she's Birgitta out of the legends? I mean, the bow and the braid? Every tale mentions those, even if her bow isn't silver, and I can't think she was born with the name."
"She was born with it," Elaine said carefully.
It was true, in a way. Best to steer the talk another way. "Nynaeve still can't decide whether I'm a friend or somebody she has to browbeat into doing what she thinks right. And she spends more time remembering I'm her queen's daughter than I do. I think she holds it against me sometimes. You never do that." "Maybe I'm not so impressed." Min wore a grin, but on the other she sounded serious. "I was born in the mountains of mist, Elaine, at the mines. Your mother's writ runs pretty thin that far west." The smile vanished from her face. "I'm sorry, Elaine." Stifling a flash of indignation, Min was every bit as much a subject of the Lion Throne as Nynaeve. Elaine let her head fall back against the tree.
Let's talk of something happy.
The sun sat molten overhead through the branches. The sky was a clear sheet of blue, unmarked by even one cloud to the horizon. On impulse, she opened herself to Saidar and let it fill her, as though all the joy of life in the world had been distilled and every drop in her veins replaced with the essence. If she could make just one cloud form, it would be a sign that everything would come out all right. Her mother would be alive, Rand would love her, and Mogedion would be dealt with, somehow. She wove a tenuous web through the sky as far as she could see, using air and water, searching for the moisture for a cloud. If she only strained hard enough... The sweetness quickly built close to pain, the danger sign. Draw much more of the power and she could still herself. Just one little cloud. Happy? Min said. Well, I know you don't want to talk about Rand, but aside from you and me, he's still the most important thing in the world right now. And the happiest. Forsaken fall dead when he appears, and nations line up to bow. The Aes Sedai here are ready to support him. I know they are, Elaine, they have to. Why, next Elida will hand the tower over to him. The last battle will be a walk for him. He's winning, Elaine. We're winning. Releasing the source, Elaine sagged back, staring at a sky as empty as her mood had become. You did not need to be able to channel to see the Dark One's hand at work, and if he could touch the world this much, if he could touch it at all... Are we? She said, but too softly for men to hear. The manor house was unfinished yet, the great room's tall wooden panels pale and unstained, but Fail Nibashir Tebara held court every afternoon, as proper for the lord's wife, in a massive high-backed chair carved with falcons, just in front of a bare stone fireplace that mirrored another at the end of the room, the empty chair by her side, carved with wolves and a large wolf's head at its peak, should have been occupied by her husband, Perrin Tibashir Ebarra, Perrin Goldeneyes, Lord of the Two Rivers. Of course, the manor was only an overgrown farmhouse. The great room stretched fewer than 15 paces. How Perrin had stared when she insisted on it being that big. He was still used to thinking of himself as a blacksmith, or even a blacksmith's apprentice, and the name given her at birth had been Zareen, not Fail. These things did not matter. Zareen was a name for a languorous woman who sighed tremulously over poems composed to her smiles. Fail, the name she had chosen as a sworn hunter for the Horn of Valir, meant falcon in the old tongue. No one who got a good look at her face with its bold nose and high cheekbones and dark, tilted eyes that flashed when she was angry could doubt which suited her best. For the rest, intentions counted a great deal. So did what was right and proper. Her eyes were flashing at the moment. It had nothing to do with Perrin's stubbornness and little with the unseasonable heat, though, in truth, futilely working a pheasant feather fan for a breeze against the sweat sliding down her cheeks did not help her temper at all. This late in the afternoon, few remained of the crowd who had come to have her judge their disputes. Actually, they came for Perrin to hear them, but the idea of passing judgment on people he had grown up among horrified him. Unless she managed to corner the man, he vanished like a wolf in fog when it came time for the daily audience. Luckily the people did not mind it when Lady Fail heard them instead of Lord Perrin, or few did, anyway, and those wise enough to hide the fact. "You brought this to me," she said in a flat voice. The two women, perspiring before her chair, shuffled their feet uneasily and studied the polished floorboards. Coppery-skinned Sharmad Zafar's plump curves were covered, if far from obscured, by a high-necked but barely opaque Domani dress, the pale golden silk worn at hem and cuffs, still with a sprinkling of small travel stains beyond cleaning. Silk was silk, after all, and seldom to be had here. Patrols into the mountains of mist, searching for remnants of the past summer's Trolloc invasion, found few of the bestial Trollocs, and no Murdral, thank the light. But they did find refugees nearly every day.
10 here, 20 there, 5 somewhere else. Most came out of Almuth Plain, but a good many from Tarabon, and like Sharmad from Arad Doman, all fleeing lands ruined by anarchy on top of civil war. Fael did not want to think of how many died in the mountains. Lacking roads or even paths, the mountains were no easy journey in the best of times, and these were far from the best. Rey Avin was no refugee. For all she wore a copy of a Taraboner dress in fine woven wool, soft gray folds that molded and emphasized almost as much as Sharmad's thinner garb. Those who survived the long trek over the mountains brought more than troubling rumors, skills previously unseen in the two rivers, and hands to work farms depopulated by the Trollocs. Rey was a pretty round-faced woman born not 2 miles from where the manor now stood, her dark hair in a wrist-thick braid to her waist. In the two rivers, girls did not braid their hair until the women's circles said they were old enough to marry, whether that was 15 or 30, though few went beyond 20. In fact, Rey was a good 5 years older than Fael, her hair 4 years braided, but at the moment she looked as if she still wore it loose on her shoulders, and had just realized that what had seemed a wonderful idea at the time was really the stupidest thing she could have done. For that matter, Sharmad seemed even more abashed, for all she had a year or two on Rey. For a Damani to find herself in this situation must be humiliating. Fael wanted to slap the pair of them cross-eyed, except that a lady could not do that. "A man," she said as levelly as she could manage, "is not a horse or a field. Neither of you can own him. And to ask me to say which has the right to him." She drew a slow breath. "If I thought Will Alcine had been leading you both on, I might have had something to say on the matter. Will had an eye for the women, and they for him. He had very well turned calves, but he never made promises." Sharmad looked ready to sink into the floor. Domani women had a reputation for twining men around their fingers, after all, not the other way around. "As it is, this is my judgment. You will both go to the Wisdom and explain matters to her, leaving nothing out. She will handle this. I expect to hear that she's seen you before nightfall." The pair flinched. Daisy Kongar, the Wisdom here in Emmons Field, would not tolerate this sort of nonsense. In fact, she would go well beyond not tolerating it. But they curtsied, muttering, "Yes, my lady," in forlorn unison. If not already, they soon would sorely regret wasting Daisy's time. "And mine," Fael thought firmly. Everyone knew Perrin rarely sat in audience, or they would never have brought their fool problem. Had he been here where he belonged, they would have slipped away rather than air it in front of him. Fael hoped the heat had Daisy in a prickle. Too bad there was no way to get Daisy to take Perrin in hand. San Bui replaced the women almost before they could get out of the way on dragging feet. Despite leaning heavily on a walking staff nearly as gnarled as himself, he managed a florid bow, then spoiled it by raking bony fingers through lank, thinning hair. As usual, his rough brown coat looked slept in. "The light shine on you, my lady Fael, and on your honored husband, the Lord Perrin." The grand words sounded odd in his scratchy voice. "Let me add my wishes for your continued happiness to those of the council. Your intelligence and beauty make our lives brighter, as does the justice of your pronouncements." Fael drummed her fingers on the arm of her chair before she could stop herself. Flowery praises instead of the normal sour grumbling, reminding her that he sat on the Emmons Field village council and so was a man of influence, due respect, and playing for sympathy with that staff. The Thatcher was as spry as anyone half his age. He wanted something. "What do you bring me today, Master Bui?" Sen straightened, forgetting to prop himself up with his stick, and forgetting to keep the acrid note out of his voice. "It's all these outlanders flooding in, bringing all sorts of things we don't want here." He seemed to have forgotten she was an outlander, too. Most Two Rivers folks had. "Strange ways, my lady. In decent clothes. You'll be hearing from the women about the way those Damani hussies dress if you haven't already." She had, as it happened, from some of them, though a momentary gleam in Sen's eye said he would regret it if she gave in to their demands. "Strangers stealing the food from our mouths, taking away our trade. That Tarabonner fellow and his fool tile-making, for example. Taking up hands that could be put to useful work. He doesn't care about good Two Rivers people. Why, he..." Fanning herself, she stopped listening while giving every appearance of paying close attention. It was a skill her father had taught her, necessary at times like this. "Of course. Master Hornval's roof tiles would compete with Sen's thatchwork." Not everyone felt as Sen did about the newcomers. Harald Luhan, the Emmonsfield blacksmith, had gone into partnership with Damani Cutler and a whitesmith from Almouth Plain. And Master Idair had hired 3 men and 2 women who knew furniture making and carving, and gilding as well, though there certainly was no gold lying about for that. Her chair and Perrin's were their work, and as fine as she'd seen anywhere. For that matter, Sen himself had taken on 6 helpers, and not all Two Rivers folk. A good many roofs had burned when the Trollocs came, and new houses were going up everywhere. Perrin had no right to make her listen to this nonsense alone. The people of the Two Rivers might have proclaimed him their lord, as well they might after he led them to victory over the Trollocs, and he might be beginning to realize he could not change that, as he certainly should when they bowed and called him Lord Perrin to his face, right after he told them not to. Yet he dug in his heels at the trappings that went with being a lord, all the things that people expected from their lords and ladies. Worse, he balked at the duties of a lord. Fael knew those things exactly, as the eldest surviving child of Davram Tegaleen Bashir, Lord of Bashir, Tyre, and Sedona, guardian of the Blight Border, defender of the Heartland, Marshal General to Queen Tenobia of Saldea. True, she had run away to become a hunter for the Horn, and then given that up for a husband, which sometimes still stunned her. But she remembered. Perrin listened when she explained, and even nodded his head in the proper places, but trying to make him actually do any of it was like trying to make a horse dance the Sassara. Sen finally ran down in splutters, only just remembering to swallow the invective that bubbled behind his teeth. "Perrin and I chose to use thatch," Fael said calmly. While Sen was still nodding in self-satisfaction, she added, "You haven't finished it yet." He gave a start. "You seem to have taken on more roofs than you can handle, Master Bui. If ours isn't done soon, I fear we will have to ask Master Hornval about his tiles." Sen's mouth worked in vigorous silence. If she put a tile roof on the manor, others would follow. "I have enjoyed your discourse, but I am sure you would rather finish my roof than waste time in idle conversation, however pleasant." Lips thinning, Sen glowered for a moment, then made a sketchy bow. Muttering something unintelligible except for a strangled "my lady" at the end, he stalked out, thumping the bare floor with his stick. The things people found to waste her time. Perrin was going to do his share of this if she had to tie him hand and foot. The rest were not so provoking. A once stout woman, her patched flower-embroidered dress hanging on her like a sack, who had come all the way from Toman Head, beyond Almouth Plain, wanted to deal in herbs and cures. Hulking John Ayelin rubbing his bald head, and skinny, sad Torfin twisting the lapels of his coat, disputing the boundaries of their fields. 2 dark Damani men in long leather vests, with close-trimmed beards. Miners who thought they had seen signs of gold and silver nearby on their way through the mountains, and iron, though they were less interested in that. And finally a wiry Tarabonner, a transparent veil across her narrow face, and her pale hair in a multitude of thin braids, who claimed to have been a master carpet weaver, and to know the making of rug looms. The woman with an interest in herbs Fael directed to the local women's circle. If Espara Soman knew what she was about, they would find her a place under one of the village wisdoms. With all the new people coming in, many in a bad way from the journey, not a wisdom in the Two Rivers but had an apprentice or two, and all were on the lookout for more. Maybe not exactly what Espara wanted, but where she would have to start. A few questions made it plain that neither Thad nor John really remembered where the boundary lay. Apparently they had been arguing it since before she was born, so she directed them to split the difference, which seemed to be what each had thought the village council would decide, the reason for keeping the argument between themselves so long. The others she granted the permission they sought. They did not really need permission, but it was best to let them know where authority lay from the start. In return for her consent and enough silver to buy supplies, Fael made the two Domani agree to give Perrin a tenth part of what they found, as well as to locate the iron mentioned in passing. Perrin would not like it, but the two rivers had nothing like taxes, and a lord was expected to do things and provide things that required money, and the iron would be as useful as the gold. As for Liala Mosrara, if the Tarabona claimed more skill than she had, her enterprise would not last long. But if she did, 3 cloth weavers already ensured that the merchants would find more than raw wool when they came down from Bearlon next year, and decent carpets would be another trade item to bring in more coin. Liala promised the first and finest from her looms to the manor, and Fael nodded a gracious acceptance of the gift. She could give more if and when the carpets appeared. The floors did need covering. All in all, everyone seemed reasonably satisfied, even John and Thad. As the Tarabonner woman backed away curtsying, Fael stood, glad to be done, then stopped when 4 women entered through one of the doorways that flanked the far fireplace, all sweating in dark, stout Two Rivers woolens. Daisy Congar, as tall as most men and wider, overtopped the other wisdoms and thrust herself forward to take the lead here on the outskirts of her own village. Adela Galen from Watch Hill, gray-braided and slender, made it plain with her straight back and stiff face that she thought she should have Daisy's place by virtue of age and her long time in office, if no other reason. Elwyn Taran, the wisdom of Devon Ride, was the shortest, a round woman with a pleasant motherly smile that she wore even when she was making people do what they did not want to. The last, Mila Alazar from Taran Ferry, trailed behind. The youngest, almost young enough to be Adela's daughter, she always appeared uncertain around the others. Fael remained standing, fanning herself slowly. She truly wished Perrin there now, very much. These women had as much authority in their villages as the mayor, sometimes in some ways more, and they had to be handled carefully, with due dignity and respect. That made matters difficult. They turned into simpering girls around Perrin, eager to please, but with her, the Two Rivers had had no nobles in centuries. They had not seen so much as a representative of the queen in Camelin for 7 generations. Everyone was still working out how to behave toward a lord and lady, including these 4. Sometimes they forgot she was the Lady Fael and saw only a young woman whose marriage Daisa had presided over just a few months ago. They could be all curtsies and, "Yes, of course, my lady," and right in the middle of it tell her exactly what to do about something without seeing anything at all incongruous. "You are not going to leave this to me any more, Perrin." They curtsied now with varying degrees of skill and said, "The light shine on you, my lady," on top of one another. Amenities out of the way, Daisa started in before she was completely upright again. 3 more boys have run off, my lady." Her tone fell halfway between the respect of the words and the "now you listen to me, young woman," she sometimes used. "Dava Yellen, Ewan Fingar, and Elam Dautry. Run off to see the world because of Lord Perrin's stories about what's out there." Fael blinked in surprise. Those 3 were hardly boys. Dav and Elam were as old as Perrin, and Ewan was her own age. And Perrin's stories, which he told seldom and reluctantly, were hardly the only way Two Rivers youths learned about the outside world now. "I could ask Perrin to speak to you, if you wish." They stirred, Daisa looking for him expectantly, Adela and Mila automatically smoothing their skirts, Elwyn just as unconsciously drawing her braid over her shoulder and arranging it carefully. Abruptly, they realized what they were doing and froze, not looking at one another or at her. The one advantage Fael had with them was that they knew the effect her husband had on them. So many times she had seen one or another firm herself up after meeting with Perrin, plainly vowing not to let it happen again. So many times she had seen resolution fly out of the window at a sight of him. None was really sure whether she preferred to deal with him or with her. "That will not be necessary," Adela said after a moment. "Boys running off are a bother, but only a bother." Her tone had slid a little further from my lady than Daze's, and plump Elwyn added a smile suitable for mother to young daughter. "As long as we're here, my dear, we really might as well mention something else. Water. You see, some of the people are worried." "It hasn't rained in months," Adela added, and Daze nodded. This time Fael did blink. They were too intelligent to think Perrin could do anything about that.